Good morning, and if you'll be turning to Isaiah chapter 19, that's where we're going to resume our study in Isaiah this morning, and we'll see how far we get. I'm not gonna make any promises. As I look at the prospect of covering the whole book of Isaiah, it's going to take a while, obviously, but as good a stuff there is in the beginning of the book, there's even more good stuff at the end, and so I have to skip a little bit here at the front so we can have time to discuss some of the things toward the end that are a little bit of deeper significance, simply because the amount of time attention is given to it in the New Testament and the connection that is made. But I think, as we will see this morning, there's plenty here in the early part as well that is along the same line, and so I didn't want to skip too quickly over this section on Egypt we were looking at. And as you can see, our outline we've had before is basically cataloging these different oracles that we have in this section. I've called God's judgment on the nations as just a kind of a general description. And clearly the section is outlined by having a series of oracles that Isaiah has about various nations, starting with Babylon, and then other nations in the vicinity of Judah, and how the current crisis with the Assyrians impacts Judah's relationship with her neighbors and so on. And basically the message here is Judah shouldn't get too excited about the prospect of what's going to happen to the Assyrians, because there is still judgment that is coming because of the poor choices God's people have made. And that continues now in chapter 19, where we have in chapter 19 and 20 an oracle about Egypt. And it's typical in the first half of this chapter, God's going to bring various judgments against the Egyptians. The imagery of drying up the Nile River and all of their produce will come to naught and all of that. And of course, the purpose of this is similar to some of the previous instructions that Isaiah has given. Don't trust in Egypt because of the former military power of Egypt and so on. There's this temptation to make alliances with the Egyptians. And that will be our hedge against Assyrian power. The Assyrians and the Egyptians were, constant enemies with one another, vying for control. And of course, they're poor little Palestine stuck in the middle between the two. And so, if you want to try to hold off the might of Assyria, well, the Egyptians would seem like a very good option from any kind of political strategic perspective. But Isaiah is saying, don't trust in Egypt. That's not going to do it. And in fact, the failure of Egypt will become abundant and clear. Now, what I would like to look at here, though, is picking up in verse 16, you find something here that's quite extraordinary. And a couple of ways that this is indicated is most of these oracles are in poetry, as most of the prophets are, but here the prophet reverts back to prose. And also you'll notice the expression "in that day" occurs repeatedly in this section. Verse 16, verse 18, verse 19, verse 23, verse 24. And that gives this section a kind of a sense of it being a unit for one. But also it strikes the reader as being more futuristic, so to speak, because this is a term that, of course, from the prophetic perspective, it would just mean sometime in the future. But after the New Testament, we look back on this, and often you will see how that day comes to be the day of the Lord that is fulfilled in Jesus Christ and so on. And I think that will become obvious as we look at this section. And this fivefold repetition of "in that day" kind of is a five-step process by which Isaiah is indicating here that Egypt will actually become like Israel. Now, if you had to historically pick any event or time period in human history where Egypt became like Israel, what would you pick? There isn't any. There's no way. The only way this could be fulfilled is in some spiritual sense, again, as people come to God and become part of God's people. And you think in terms particularly, for example, of chapter 2. Remember the vision that Isaiah had there? All nations will flow to Jerusalem. And when do we typically think of that being fulfilled? In Jesus Christ and the preaching of the gospel. There was never a literal occurrence in which the nations of the earth flowed to Jerusalem and so on to become part of the this new Davidic empire and so on. But this does come true in Christ. And so what we have here is simply a specific application of that same principle from chapter 2 now applied to the Egyptians in chapter 19. And it makes a really powerful statement. Because in the first 15 verses of this chapter, what Isaiah has in essence been saying is, Egypt should have no appeal for you. Don't be attracted to the strength of Egypt. Don't think you can rely upon Egypt. Judah should not be looking to Egypt. In fact, then, in the latter half of this chapter, he says, Egypt will be looking toward Judah. Because Judah possesses the only thing that people really want or need. Now, that doesn't mean people acknowledge it. We try to fill this need with drugs or sex or power or money or any number of other things. But what we're all really looking for is God, ultimately. And Judah is the one that possesses the only thing that any nation on the face of the earth really wants or really needs. And so Isaiah is speaking of Egypt now, in some sense, coming to recognize that need and looking toward Judah. And so how absurd it would be for Judah to look to Egypt when Egypt's just going to turn around and be looking toward Judah. So that's the burden of this. So notice verses 16 and 17, the beginning of this turn of the Egyptians is to look toward Judah in fear and dread. In that day the Egyptians will become like women. They will tremble and be in dread because of the waving of the hand of the Lord of hosts, which he's going to wave over them. And the land of Judah will become a terror to Egypt. Everyone to whom it is mentioned will be in dread of it because of the purpose of the Lord of hosts, which he is purposing against them. And of course, Egypt had often been a kind of source of dread and fear to other nations. You know, when people talk about the might of Egypt and other nations would tremble, well, now again, the shoe's on the other foot. When Judah is mentioned, Egypt will tremble. Now, you think of the absurdity of that. Judah's this kind of small, minor kingdom. Egypt's still a pretty powerful nation. But there were occasions previously when the Egyptians trembled at Judah. And when was that? Well, there would be times, for example, during the glory days of David and Solomon, where God's people were powerful enough to make neighboring nations tremble. What about the Egyptians specifically? During the Exodus would be probably the prototypical fear that the Egyptians had of course, it wasn't called Judah then, but God's people, Israel. And so there's going to be something of a renewal of that, the same kind of things that God did to the Egyptians. Some of that's been alluded to in the first 15 verses here. And so, as before, the Egyptians will fear God's people. But now notice verse 18 takes a little step closer. In that day, five cities in the land of Egypt will be speaking the language of Canaan and swearing allegiance to Yahweh of hosts. And one will be called the City of Destruction. This is one of the most bizarre verses in the Bible. I'll just admit that up front. So what do you make of this? Well, Calvin's view was that there will be five cities in Egypt that will turn to the Lord, they're going to buy into the culture of Canaan to such an extent they'll start speaking the language of God's people who live in Canaan. And there'll be five cities out of every six, and that sixth city is going to be a city destined for destruction. And so it would say, yeah, there's still always going to be some that hold out and want to be destroyed, but it'll be a great majority. To which I would say that's probably not the most natural reading of that way of looking at that verse.
This city of destruction, I have a note that says Dead Sea Scrolls, some other manuscripts call it the city of the sun.
City of the sun, right. And that's another thing that adds to the challenge of reading this. In fact, I do believe that's probably the correct reading. This is one of those cases where the two words are identical, except for just one little line you connect with another line. If you don't connect it, if you leave a little gap, it's the word destruction. And if you connect it, it's the word sun. Obviously, that little kind of just blot of ink there makes all the difference in the world as to what the word is. Of course, sun and destruction don't sound anything alike to us, but we know words like that. I have to think of one off the top of my head. You know, tar and tan, you know, how some people write their N's or their R's. You sometimes wonder, you know, is that rounding part of the R coming all the way down as a full N, or did they stop short, or what? And so you can have two completely different words just based upon just a small part of the letter either being extra or missing. And as Shane mentioned, that Isaiah scroll that was found at the Dead Sea reads City of the Sun, and also the Aramaic Targums and the Latin Vulgate, and probably even the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament supports this reading. Now, what they've done is something different. They put the word righteousness there, but there was a well-known phrase in the Old Testament, the Son of Righteousness, which may have led to that connection of righteousness with the Son and came to substitute for it. But what's intriguing about taking it that way, of course, is, was there such a place in Egypt called the City of the Sun? That's right. Amon-Re was their main god, which makes sense because of all the crocodiles and jackals and buzzards and everything else you could worship. Anything in nature, the sun is always made a logical god because it's just so overwhelming and bright. You can't even look at the thing. So, you know, there's a power there that, you know, I can look at a buzzard, you know, don't think too much of it. It's hideously ugly. Oh, let's worship the buzzard. I'd much rather worship the sun and think I'm worshiping something worthwhile. And so Heliopolis, of course, was the Greek name for this place. May be saying, I mean, for one thing, it'd be extraordinary even one city of the Egyptians would adopt the culture of God's people. So five would really be extraordinary. But especially if one of them was the city of the sun and turned to God. But then notice verse 19, now we progress even further. In that day there will be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar to the Lord near its border. And it'll be a sign and a witness to the Lord of hosts in the land of Egypt. And they will cry to the Lord because of oppressors, and he will send them a savior and a champion, and he will deliver them. Now, what does that sound like? They cry out in their oppression, and the Lord sends a deliverer. Sounds like the book of Judges, and even before then, in the Exodus, when the people crying out under Egyptian oppression. So, it's starting to sound like the Egyptians are like God's people, and imitating the same experiences that Israel has had. And again, you ask, well, when did this ever happen? Well, again, in Christ, it will happen. The Lord will make himself known to Egypt, and the Egyptians will know the Lord in that day. They will worship with sacrifice and offering and make a vow to the Lord and perform it. And so they're going to be obedient. They'll know the Lord and obey him. And the Lord will strike Egypt, striking but healing, so that they will turn to the Lord, and he will respond to them and heal them. And again, you see that in the prophets all of the time. The prophets tell the people, God's going to strike you in judgment, but it's for your good, to cause you to repent and turn back to him because the Lord loves you. And what kind of relationship do we find this kind of tough love going on in? Yeah, father-child kind of relationship. Well, that's kind of an intriguing thought that God would picture Egyptians as his own children, and he's like a father to them that is looking for their good and their healing and so on. Well, verse 23, in that day there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria. Now, as soon as we read that in our culture, we're thinking, my taxes are going to go up. It's going to cost four times the original cost estimate. And, you know, do we really need another highway, you know? But in the context of Palestine, of Judea, you know, what kind of terrain do you have there? Very mountainous, rocky. A highway is like space travel. I mean, it's like, you know, you can get from here to there just in an instant. You know, that's the idea. So a highway, you know, if Isaiah were writing today, he'd say something like there'd be a rocket ship or a bullet train or something. You know, there's going to be this just completely open and free and quick access that takes place all the way from Egypt to Assyria. So here are these two notorious enemies of one another, but they're actually going to be connected together. And the Assyrians will come to Egypt, and the Egyptians will go to Assyria. And, of course, not for the purpose of attacking one another. They've done that plenty enough times. But the Egyptians will worship along with the Assyrians. And then finally, it climaxes in this ultimate depiction, then, in the last step. In that day, Israel will be the third, along with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the earth, whom the Lord of hosts is blessed, saying, blessed is Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance. And of course, what people are most often referred to as my people in the Old Testament? Israel, and who's referred to as the work of my hands? Israel again. Well, these terms are now being applied to Egypt and Assyria. Well, again, you would not find any historical fulfillment of this when there's some intercontinental highway tying Egypt and Assyria together and all this. This is a fabulous depiction of life in Jesus Christ, where enemies are brought into a fellowship with one another, and all are a blessing. And just think how this would have fallen like just complete thunderbolts on the ears of the people back in Isaiah's day. Here they're ancient enemies, the Egyptians, and our current enemies we're dealing with, the Assyrians, and here Isaiah is talking about them being all God's people, all to be a blessing, all just kind of equal together, so to speak. And what it reinforces again, a very powerful way, is God is master and sovereign father of all peoples, all nations. And that, of course, would also humble Judah and put them in their proper place. Right. And I think that is part of the symbolism, the centrality of Israel being located between these two powers. And there is a special place Israel has in bringing this knowledge of God to the world, and, as you say, going through Israel to get there. So, again, that's just extraordinary. I mean, to try to put yourself in the shoes of a 8th century Israelite and hear a prophet come along and say something like this, and it just blow your mind. And yet, and it's one of those things you just scratch your head about and say, when in the world is this going to happen? And so when it does happen in Jesus Christ, I mean, there's no way you could read this and say, oh, I know what this means. In 700 years, the Messiah is going to come along and do all this. No, you'd have no clue whatsoever. And yet after it happens, you could see someone like Paul saying, have you people ever read Isaiah 19? That's something that's never going to happen geopolitically. It happens in Jesus Christ as, you know, the hearts of people are brought into submission to God. I mean, what God's concerned about is not some lump of dirt that is bordered by whatever the boundaries of your nation are. You know, this is Egypt here, you know, this is Assyria here. He's concerned about the hearts of people And he's looking to rule in the hearts of the Assyrians, the Egyptians, the Israelites, you know, whoever you want to add to that list, all peoples, he would rule in their hearts, not as a tyrant, not as a dictator. You know, God could rule over the earth just by, you know, coercion of all kinds of means, but he wants to rule with that sacrificial love that he will exemplify in Jesus. Now, that being said, chapter 20 now is a return to wrap this thing up and return to the immediate situation, which is the problem of Egypt and trusting in Egypt and how any such reliance on Egypt will ultimately bring you to shame. And so, again, Isaiah's main point is don't turn to Egypt. Don't rely on Egypt. In fact, one day you're going to see how foolish it is because the Egyptians are going to be looking to you and wanting to imitate you and become you. But for the present right now, notice it says in chapter 20, verse 1, in the year that the commander came to Ashdod, when Sargon, king of Assyria, sent him, and he fought against Ashdod and captured it. So that's the setting for what happens here. And so it gives us one of the few historical clues of what's going on in the book. Now, what happened was, of course, you remember Tiglath-Pileser, he's the one that started the whole Assyrian Empire thing, 745. And then he was succeeded by Shalmaneser V. And he was the one responsible for bringing judgment against the northern kingdom of Israel and carrying them off into captivity. But he died the same year that the capital city Samaria fell. And so his successor, Sargon II, of course, took credit for the sacking of Samaria. And it was his job then to, rule Assyria. And of course, the first thing that happens anytime a emperor dies is everybody revolts. And they're testing the waters to see how this new inexperienced guy is going to handle things. And everybody found out that one Assyrian emperor was, if anything, more efficient and brutal than the one before. And so Sargon didn't prove to be anyone to mess with at all. But it did take him about a decade of putting out fires all over his empire and keeping things under control. So while Sargon is busy doing all of that, what do you think the Egyptians are up to? Well, being good politicians and strategists, they're going to try to manipulate the situation to their advantage. And at this time, there is an Ethiopian dynasty in control of Egypt, a pharaoh by the name of Shabako. And he's just fomenting rebellion all that he can in the western reaches of Sargon's empire. And, of course, he got the Philistines involved in this thing. And so the city of Ashdod was the leading revolt city in the area of the Philistines. And so you can imagine what Sargon thought about the people in Ashdod. And when he got his affairs in order in the east, and he eventually made his way over to the west, Ashdod was going to be singled out particularly for some of his payback. And so what happened in the city of Ashdod is Sargon had a fellow who was ruling over the city for him, a fellow by the name of Ahimati, and under the influence of the Egyptians, they had deposed this guy and replaced him with a fellow named Yamani. And once the Assyrians came, Yamani fled to Egypt for asylum. He saw the handwriting on the wall and he knew his days were numbered and he was going to get out of there and go visit his good friends, the Egyptians. And of course, the Assyrians punished the city of Ashdod and tried to make an object lesson of them and those kind of things. But what happens, of course, is the Assyrian army is right there on the doorstep of Egypt. And they're not powerful enough yet to invade Egypt. That's going to come in due time. But the Egyptians are so afraid of the Assyrians that they give in to the demands of the Assyrians. And what the Assyrians said was, you give us Yamani. You hand him over. And not only did the Egyptians hand him over, they themselves took him all the way to Assyria to deliver him to the Assyrians. So, you know, it is otherwise a rather insignificant story in the history of great geopolitics of the Assyrians and the Egyptians and all of that, this little city of the Philistines, Ashdod, and what happened to their little petty king. Yet Isaiah looks at this one story, which would have been quite recent, and say, here is a perfect example of the kind of thing I'm talking about, that you can't trust in Egypt. Those that do will find themselves humiliated and put to shame. And here's just one little example of that. And so that's the setting of this particular event. So we can date this. The Pharaoh that came to power was in 714. 713 was when he was successful in getting the Philistines to revolt, and when they deposed this guy in Ashdod and put Yamani in his place. And it takes a couple years for Sargon to get over there, but in 711 is when Ashdod was sacked. And of course, just prior to that, this Yamani character had fled to Egypt for protection. Just like Judah wants to flee to Egypt for protection, but did he get any protection there? No. As a matter of fact, the Egyptians handed him over. And anyone that tries to trust in the Egyptians, that's the same kind of treatment you're going to get. You can't depend upon them. And the other thing that's here is this is one of the most peculiar stories with Isaiah, because when you read Jeremiah and Ezekiel, one of the things you're struck about is they did all these weird things. You know, God would tell Jeremiah, you know, go bury a garment in the, or Ezekiel, go bury this garment in the banks of the river, and you go back and dig it up later. And you know, Jeremiah had to go buy this worthless piece of property and go break this pottery jar, and you know, and so you know, the prophets are doing these bizarre, you know, dig a hole in the wall and crawl out in it, or lay, you know, on your side for days on end, you know, and you're only eating a little bit of bread and drinking a little bit of water. I mean, all these bizarre things. Well, we only know of one bizarre thing that God ever asked Isaiah to do as a similar kind of object lesson or parable in action or whatever you want to call it, and it's this here, where he goes around naked for 3 years. Now, that doesn't mean it has to be a full 3 years, because, you know, the way the Israelites counted time, if you had just even the last month of 1 year and the next year and just another month of the next year, that would be 3 years to them, much like Jesus was in the tomb for 3 days. But it really was only a couple of hours, you know, on Friday, and then all day on Saturday, and then however many hours he was in the nighttime portion of that day, of the first day of the week. But 39 hours maximum Jesus could have been in the tomb, but the Bible says 3 days. And so it was some time period in here, and that corresponds with the amount of time that Ashdod was in rebellion and that the Assyrians show up and destroy the city and so on. So it appears to me that Isaiah's object lesson was a pointer to the fact that God was going to use Ashdod as an example, and when the prisoners of Ashdod are being led off by the Assyrians, old and young, stripped, naked, prisoners were often stripped like that. Now, it wasn't all the time. I mean, we have pictures of prisoners who have clothes on, so it wasn't like a universal thing that always was done. But it served a very practical function. It's harder to escape when you're completely naked. You know, you got to worry about being protected from the elements and things like that. But probably more than that, it served a psychological function. It's just humiliating and so on. And so Isaiah is being called to live this way for this lengthy period, at least over a year, at least 14 months to qualify as that three-year period, and maybe, you know, a year and a half or up to 2 years or something like that. But it was to teach a lesson. This is the way people who come under God's judgment are going to be humiliated, and their shame is going to be exposed, and so on. Now, does that mean Isaiah had to go around completely naked? I don't think that's the case. this word can refer to complete nudity. It's the same word used in Genesis 2:25, for example, with Adam and Eve. But it's also used on a lot of other occasions, and similar wording is used of people that are only partly clothed. You know, where, and we do the same thing around the house. You know, Andrew will be changing, he's in his underwear, and say, "Well, who's this naked boy?" You know, well, he's not completely naked. Peter, you'll remember in John 21, he was out there fishing, and it says he was naked. Well, not because he was completely naked, but he had taken off his outer garment and the inner garment. They just left, you know, basically you're standing there in your underwear or some kind of loincloth. Well, that appears to be more, you know, what Isaiah is doing here. That would have been sufficient to get the message across. It would still be just as humiliating and shameful and so on. And so this is the one event in which Isaiah is called to do this kind of thing. Now, the thing I would mention is that it is possible to read chapter 20 here as saying that when Ashdod was captured, that's the point at which the Lord said, "Okay, now here's what I want you to do, Isaiah. I want you to run around, you know, half naked to make some kind of point." which then the question would be, well, what's the point, you know? But again, what you often have in the Bible from the Hebrew storytelling point of view is you'll get a summary statement that, you know, in the big picture, what happened was the Assyrians came and sacked Ashdod and so on. But then it goes back and picks up part of the story that happened before that. And I think that's what's happening here, where the topic gets introduced. Let's talk about Ashdod, when the Assyrians took Ashdod. Well, the Lord had said to Isaiah that he wanted him to go around naked, to loosen the sackcloth from your hips, take the shoes off your feet. And he did so, going naked and barefoot. And the purpose of that was not obvious until after the humiliation of Egypt becomes revealed in this incident with Ashdod. And so then the statement of verse 3 would happen at the time when Ashdod falls. "Even as my servant Isaiah has gone naked and barefoot 3 years as a sign and token against Egypt and Cush," or Ethiopia, "so the king of Assyria will lead away the captives of Egypt and the exiles of Ethiopia, young and old, naked and barefoot, with their buttocks exposed to the shame of Egypt. And they shall be dismayed and ashamed because of Ethiopia their hope and Egypt their boast. And the inhabitants of this coastland will say in that day, 'Behold, such is our hope, where we fled for help to be delivered from the king of Assyria. And we, how shall we escape?'" And so again, you can see the Philistines saying, "Well, that was our hope. Now what?" And that's where everybody's going to be left who tries to put their hope and confidence in Egypt. And of course, you have here kind of a future pronouncement of the humiliation of Egypt as well. It isn't just Egyptian strength is seen to be weakness over the event that happens at Ashdod, but that itself foreshadows Egypt's going to fall even further. And it's going to be in 671, another Assyrian emperor, Esarhaddon, is going to come in and actually invade Egypt and take it over. And that'll really mark the kind of end of Egypt as she had been known up to that point. So, well, any questions or points about chapter 20? Or now, let me ask you this, though. Put yourselves in Isaiah's shoes, although he was asked not to wear any shoes. How do you think he felt being called by God to do this? Oh, it would have had to have been. It was very similar. I think of God asked Ezekiel to cook his food over human excrement. And you remember what he said? He said, "God, I can't do that, please." And God said, "Okay, you can use cow manure instead." You know, so the Lord relented on that. But so, you know, but that must have been just, that'd be my first reaction too. "Oh, no, please, you know. I mean, there were so many of these things. God, no, please." But obviously, the Lord didn't let him out of all of it. But you know, you could read a passage like this and say, well, thank goodness we don't have to do anything like this today. But is that really true? Is there a sense in which God calls us to humiliate ourselves before the world?
Well, I think the interesting thing in his situation is there wasn't a written word that everybody else could read and say, oh, that's why he's doing that. He was getting direct command from God, and all of a sudden he's walking around with no clothes on. Mm-hmm. Everybody's trying to figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
We, on the other hand, have written word where we can go, and if someone does question what we're doing, we can show them, this is why I'm doing this mm-hmm. this way.
Right. And of course, it raises an interesting question. Did Isaiah even know why God wanted him to do this until God explained it later? Maybe not. But that's a good point. But sometimes to the world, we're going to look like we're as nutty as, you know, Isaiah was acting. Yeah, to be called to step out of our comfort zone and you know what God calls us, who's not the conventional, and so on. And you're right, it's not always humiliating in maybe some senses we may think about that. But when you think about, you know, humiliation is always a contrast to, you know, some kind of glory. But if it's the glory of this world, all of its pride and arrogance and all the things the world thinks is important, like money and so on, we are called to renounce these things. Not that we take a vow of poverty and we don't use money. That's not the point. But we don't live for the money. We don't live for the things that people take pride in. And again, the world can look at us and say, well, are you nuts? You know, or what kind of lunatic are you? Because of some of the life choices that we make. And so, again, we might often think about some of these poor prophets and what they were called on to do and what people thought of them. You know, just loony, crazy, you know, guys out there, been out there in the sun too long kind of thing. Well, we didn't get very far, but I hope it's been helpful to us. We will try to get through chapter 21 and 22 next week, and I asked you to look at chapter 22. For how it's referenced in the New Testament in particular, and see what we might make of that. But again, I appreciate your comments and your attention.